Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. I'm Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Brisgintas.
Today, we'll consider the traditions of Easter. Eggs and rabbits, death.
And we are going to have a harebrained show.
And we'll have a great harebrained show with maybe some rather hairish sort of jokes. Maybe we'll have some information on Easter things that you can eat. And this is also the return of green and growing things. I spent some time in the nice weather this last, just yesterday. I was out.
It's gorgeous out.
Oh, it's wonderful. Uh-huh. I was out in my garden dividing my daylilies. When little things start coming up, got to get out there with a shovel. It just does good to move some dirt around. It's good. So dividing daylilies, you actually can do that at almost any time. Daylilies are really tough. You know, those wonderful things like ditch lilies, they say, in the ditches around here. They do get kind of root-bound. So if you just want to go in there with a shovel, shovel them all up, shake them all loose, and put them in a new place. Do you have a place in your yard that needs a little help? Well, put a daylily there. That's what I did yesterday. So it's spring. It's spring. Things are coming up. Donna, you said your
I can see my lovage kind of unfurling, and the horseradish has got these little kind of ripples in the soil. And what else? A rhubarb. You can see the little rhubarbies. And the fat buds on the lilac bush. It's happening.
Everything looks really, really good, folks. We need a rain, but other than that, we're doing good. Why don't we do a word from our underwriter?
Yes. Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocer in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974. Open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop at Wheatsfield Co-op.
So there. This time of year, we celebrate Easter. Do you ever wonder why we call it Easter? I mean, Easter doesn't sound very Christian, death of Christ, resurrection, all that sort of thing. It doesn't even sound very Passover-ish. What is this Easter stuff? The word Easter comes from ancient spring celebrations, and it comes from the goddess Estra, E-O-S-T-R-E. And if you look on Wikipedia or wherever you want to find this stuff, this word Esther, Easter, Ostara, Astara is spelled every possible way that you could pronounce that, because this goddess has been around for a really long time.
Yeah, very pre-Christian.
Yeah. It has to do with the coming of the light, the coming of spring. And people have been celebrating that for a long time. It's when the sun comes back and we're starting to see green things again. The goddess Esther, or Ostara, was around for a long, long time. The Germanic people really grabbed onto this goddess and made it a favorite.
Probably because they had a long, cold winter. I mean, how can you not go through a winter? And then when the weather turns like this, you got to celebrate something. Absolutely.
Right. So raise a glass of beer to their goddess. Easter, Astra, Ostra. Actually,
maybe the word estrus comes from it, too.
Probably,
a fertility holiday.
Fertility. Right. And also, in Old High German, even now, it's Ostermonth. Easter month is the name of the month because it's Easter's month. It's the namesake of the festival. So the Anglo-Saxons also grabbed onto it, too. And despite the fact that the Christian church tried to call it Paschal month, as in, you know, the Passion of Christ, that just never took on. The people liked Easter a whole lot better. And more research even connects it up to the Proto-Indo-European goddess of the dawn. There's a Proto-European alphabet here, and I cannot even pronounce it, but that is also translated to something called
fertility.
Astros.
Chickens,
Astros.
Rabbits, babies.
All that kind of stuff. Christians would have you believe that Easter is about the resurrection of Jesus, but It's actually a traditional pagan holiday. Eggs and plastic grass and chocolate bunny have nothing to do with Jesus, but we all seem to celebrate with that sort of stuff. Actually, there is one ancient pre-Christian bit of the celebration that very much is connected up with the Jesus' death and Jesus' resurrection story, because this time of year, with the return of the light, a lot of ancient gods talk about birth, death. The god dies to the old world, is born anew, and Jesus doing that thing too is actually, that has been celebrated for a long, long time.
Well, I certainly feel like with this weather that I'm being resurrected. It's just wonderful.
Oh, isn't it great? Isn't it great? Anyway, so this is Easter month, Estra month, and it'll be Easter Sunday next Sunday. There's some...
Can we have a bad bunny joke now?
Oh, one thing we do have this time, and we're going to celebrate. We don't normally tell jokes on this show, but have at it. There's a lot of bunny jokes, and here comes one.
What did Bugs Bunny say to the carrot?
I don't know.
It's been nice gnawing you.
Oh.
This one is good. What do you call 10 rabbits marching backwards?
Oh, I like this one.
A receding hairline.
Oh, now see, that's good. See, bunny jokes, actually that must be part of Easter too, because everybody's looking for a good reason to smile.
Why did the rabbit cross the road? Because the chicken had his Easter eggs.
Oh, see,
rabbits. Here's another one. Why did the rabbit cross the road? Because it was the chicken's day off.
I like that one. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
These are good jokes for grandparents to have at the Easter dinner table, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
What does the Easter bunny do when it dies?
Oh, no. This is kind of awful. What does it do?
It goes to the hereafter.
Oh, I like that one. Yeah, that's good.
You might have to explain that one to the little children, but it could be funny.
That's right. I don't think... Do we have hares in North America, or do we just have bunnies?
Is a hare different from a rabbit?
Yes, a hare is much bigger. It has shorter ears.
Like a jackrabbit?
Yeah.
Oh, no, jackrabbits have big ears.
Right. A hare is...
It's not a rabbit?
Oh, see.
Dear.
It's close, but it is a different thing. I know they have hares in England and hares in Europe.
So. What do you get when you cross a bunny with an onion?
Oh, what's that one?
A bunion.
Oh, these things are getting really, really bad here.
Yeah.
Really bad. So the Easter bunny was always considered a familiar or a partner to this goddess Ostra. And that kind of went along with the fact that any powerful female deity, also maybe accused of being witches, would have familiars. They would have cats, or maybe they'd have an owl. Well, bunny rabbits were part of that, too. And in ancient, not even so ancient, in medieval pictures of the goddess that we find in Europe, like in France and in Germany, there were pictures of the Easter goddess, and she'd always be surrounded by animals, and there would always be a rabbit or two, and maybe a stork, lots of birds, and a lot of light, because that's what's being celebrated here.
So are we cooking Easter dinner this year?
Oh, Easter dinner, a time to celebrate. Actually, a time to celebrate because for a lot of traditions, people are coming off of Lent. And there was a lot
of... Break the Lenten fast,
there was a lot of fasting going on. People have given up things. Actually, one of the things that was maybe given up during the medieval times was eggs. So celebrate the eggs. Of course, the chickens aren't laying much in the late part of the winter either. So guess what? The chickens are laying well, getting those eggs back into production. And now's the time for a feast. What do you have in mind for a Easter feast?
Oh, I'm dreaming of a nice roast leg of lamb.
Oh, how
could
nice.
Could be lamb or ham, but I'm leaning towards lamb. And I like to just you either take a butterflied one, which means the bone has been taken out, or actually the whole leg. And I just, you make little incisions with the knife all over it, and you stick a slice of garlic in each of the little incisions and kind of pack it in there, and then salt and pepper, and you could put a little thyme on it or a little rosemary if you wanted to go that direction, and then stick it in the oven and roast it. I usually use the joy of cooking for the thyme and the, because I like it a little pink. And
That's one thing. I haven't cooked lamb that often, but I'm always told that it's very important to not overcook it and to make sure that, well, actually, I like it pink, too. And it's easy to get it too overdone.
Well, lamb's not going to have a lot of fat on it. So it's rather like, you know, when you're cooking, say, grass-fed beef, you know, you have to just be careful to keep it just slightly underdone so it doesn't turn into rubber. You know, it's also really good on the grill. And if you feel like getting your grill out for the beginning of the season, you could take that butterflied leg of lamb, rub it all over with olive oil, stick the cloves of garlic in it, and you could put it on the grill. And it's quite delicious that way, too.
Oh, good. And what would go with this lamb?
Well, there's nothing much in the garden yet. So I suppose we could get asparagus from southern places or even little green peas are quite traditional. There's not much left in the larder to use up there, is there?
No, except all the things you might have in your freezer. Of course, I'm sure people in the ancient world did not have their freezer to look forward to. But anyway, spring is coming, so
I do. I do have those little wild oniony things in the garden.
Oh,
mine are almost 2 inches high now. There's not much else out there. I was thinking more of the desserts, you know.
Oh, of course.
Time to get the very end of last season's rhubarb out. Or actually, my fantasy was running towards angel food cake with a lemon curd or a lemon rhubarb curd on top of it. Don't ask me why, but
that sounds good.
Something fruity and light and you know, like that. Or if you have any gooseberries left over, whatever you've still got, you know, because got to clear out the freezers because now we're going to go through the cycles again. Pretty soon we will have rhubarb.
Right. It is time to get creative with what one has put away. I notice as I'm digging around there, I still have some little frozen containers of elderberry syrup.
Elderberries, okay.
It's elderberry flower syrup.
Oh,
and it's not.
I think I'll be over for. How about if we have a champagne cocktail?
Now, see, that's
with elderberry
kind of thing.
Flower syrup.
Elderberry
syrup.
Flowers. Are,
okay, get it out,
different.
And we'll have a Sunday morning toast before
that's
we go
good.
To church. How about that?
Yeah, we'll celebrate.
Or
that.
Afterwards would be, I suppose, more
great.
Well-behaved. Anyway, time to get to the bottom of the freezer there because you're going to start a whole new cycle.
Oh, that's good. Thinking of Easter bunnies, I think we have to play at least something that's very Eastery. And Donna asked for this one.
Here comes Peter Cottontail, hopping down the bunny trail. Hippity hopping, Easter's on its way. Bring in every girl and boy, baskets full of Easter joy, things to make your Easter bright and gay. He's got jelly beans for Tommy, colored eggs for Sister Sue. There's an orchid for your mommy and an Easter bonnet too. Oh, here comes Peter Cottontail, hopping down the bunny trail. Hippity hoppity, happy Easter day.
An oldie goodie.
Yeah, an oldie but goodie. That was Gene Autry singing the Here Comes Peter Cottontail. And just think, that kind of thing was a real popular song for everybody at one time. I I kind of researched as to where that song came from, and it was sung by a number of different people, but Gene Autry was the go-to guy for singing things. He sang Here Comes Santa Claus and all that kind of stuff.
Well,
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, all that kind. So he was the person to get your seasonal song sung. So they convinced him.
For those of
him,
you that are too young to know, he was a cowboy.
Not really a cowboy.
A cowboy singer?
He was a cowboy singer. The romance of guys wearing big hats and funny cowboy shirts.
Right, fringed shirts.
He
probably had pictures of him with Roy Rogers or on a horse or...
Yeah.
Gene Autry, the singing cowboy.
Yeah.
Okay, this has got to be from the 50s at least, right?
At least.
That's the 1950s, in the last century? Okay.
Yes. Speaking of the last century, many centuries ago, the idea of this goddess Estra was first written about by a monk in the 8th century in England. Can you believe it? There was this guy named the Bede, if you've ever heard of the Venerable Bede. And although he was a Christian person in the church, he just spent a whole lot of time writing about this goddess, and you think, well, goodness, why would he write about this goddess? It seems like he was kind of not the sort of thing that the church would be talking about.
I'm surprised he didn't burn him at the stake.
No, but he didn't, and I'm just amazed to see that was in the 8th century. So at that time, because everybody was even then concerned about product placement and getting their numbers up and everything, sometimes the church just decided to go with it. And to celebrate some of these supposed heathen
things.
The pagan
holidays, yes.
Yeah. The people at the churches, people would come for the Holy Week and come for Good Friday service and stay around for the Easter celebration. And even then, colored eggs were considered a good thing to give away, and the churches would kind of give them out as door prizes. So that's very good. That's very good. Well, actually, there's a lot of reference to eggs. In Greek tradition, a god Phanes was said to have hatched from an egg, and a direct link to Easter in eggs comes from pagan Rome. The Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, when he was born, supposedly his mother's hen laid a colored egg, and that was supposed to be a good omen for him being emperor. And so, to celebrate his emperorship, he died and gave away colored eggs to everybody. That was probably buying a few votes, wouldn't you think?
I would think so. Now, what do you think they were coloring eggs with in those days?
Oh, I wonder.
Wasn't FDC number 3 yellow, green, orange, or what do you think they used?
Probably not, but I bet they had beets, and I bet they had onions. You can use onion skins.
And onion skins makes yellow?
Onion skins make yellow.
And beets, of course, will give you a pink egg.
Yes. And actually, I was trying to think of something. Well, they were also dying. They probably weren't too worried about being toxic or not. They had other things that were dyeing their robes with indigo and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I mean, considering ancient art and ancient frescoes painted on those walls, we have.
Well, I noticed at Wheatsfield they actually have a little kit that you can buy of natural egg dyes. It's quite cute. Mm-hmm. In case you haven't just looked it up on the internet to try it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And Lana made some eggs today.
Oh, yes. Now, I always color some eggs for Easter. I mean, why not? Why not? I ran across a recipe for tea eggs. Tea eggs are not traditionally a Easter thing. They were actually very popular and still are for Asian New Year's, Chinese New Year's. Tea eggs are flavored with tea and flavored with Chinese spices, and you can actually flavor them with anything. They are boiled first, cooled off a little bit, and then you crack the shells. You don't peel them, but you crack the shells till the shells are just crackly all around.
They kind of look like an older piece of pottery with the crazing on it. It's just beautiful.
Right. The black tea and the flavorings, and I used five spice powder, which is made up of cinnamon, star anise, fennel seeds, cloves, and Szechuan peppercorns. I let that soak.
So how long did these hard-boiled eggs sit to get this color?
They simmered in a strong tea and spice.
Black tea.
Black tea.
Yeah.
For 20 minutes. And then I just let the
turn
whole thing
off, cook. Turn them off and
let them sit. And then I moved the whole thing into it suggests a non-corrosive container and put them in the refrigerator overnight. And then I took them out and let them dry. Now, one thing about cooking eggs, or one thing about boiling eggs, I have very fresh eggs. So these were very fresh. They were hard to peel. One nice thing about buying eggs that have had a little bit of history to them, as in the eggs that you find in the store.
Old eggs.
Right? Older eggs. The shell loses a little bit of moisture, and they peel easier. So if you're going to boil up eggs for your Easter decorations, you might want to use slightly older eggs. Also, I let these fresh eggs sit on the counter for a while so that I could peel them.
They're delicious.
Just great, straight from under the hen. They're a little.
So I'm going to give you a little visual on this. Lana has brought in a container with about six of these little crazed, speckledy-looking hard-boiled eggs tucked in a nice plaid napkin. And then beside it is a little jar that says Peter Rabbit, sea salt, dried radishes, and dill.
Yeah.
So we're dipping the eggs in the salt, and it's quite delicious.
Yes. Yes. I would probably use more spices next time, because evidently you're supposed to add more five spice powder, and actually you can add soy sauce, too, to let that color the eggs and get into the eggs. Like I mentioned, in Asia, tea eggs are a household treat. They're sold in stores and restaurants and from street vendors. Ah, get this. In Taiwan, tea eggs are a feature of convenience stores. This is a fast food item in Taiwan. Through the 7-Eleven chains alone, an average of 40 million tea eggs are sold per year. Huh? Pretty good. In recent years, major producers of tea eggs have branched out into fruit and other flavored eggs, such as raspberry, blueberry, and salt. So new traditions start
here.
Well,
you know, an egg is a little perfect package of nutrition right there.
That's right. That's
it's got
right.
all of the amino acids complete, and the egg comes in its own prepackaged container.
And they're very pretty. I tried making them before just with tea, and they're pretty, but it's nice to put a little flavoring in there, too. So if you want eggs that look kind of marbly, do that. We'll try a little banjo music here, the Cotton Patch Rag. That was the Cotton Patch Rag. Some nice banjo music. I always can use some banjo music. You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Go to khoifm.org. Look at all of the fine things that this community radio station brings us. There's a fine place there to also find our website or our web page. You can find past shows. You can find recipes. You can find a dandy picture of Donna and us. Or you can email. If you have anything to say to Donna Lana Kitchen, if you have something to say about eggs or bunnies or bad bunny jokes, email us.
Here comes another one. Why are people always tired in April?
Oh.
Because they just finished a 31-day march.
Oh, now that's a nice one.
That's today.
That's very good. That's very good. So while colored eggs were shared in the ancient world, there's no real reason for us to connect up Easter eggs to the Christian Easter story, but eggs were relatively common in the Middle Ages and an important source of nutrition in a society where meat was a rare treat. We mentioned Lent, and that's going on at that time. So monks and priests were often given presents, payment, on important Christian holidays. So they got fancy Easter eggs, too, Easter eggs being one of those times for giving your priest a gift. Eggs were the common gift, and they were given to priests in baskets. In Russia, it was common for priests and later members of the nobility to give out eggs to all the peasants around Easter, keep the rabble happy.
It's a lot of giving and taking of eggs here.
Yeah, there you go.
Poor old chickens. Well, now here's what happens at our house. You know, you dye a bunch of eggs, and then depending on the age of the children, if the children are in the egg dyeing business, as in a little bit older, somehow they disappear and you have an egg hunt in the morning. But once you've found all those eggs, here you are with perhaps several dozen boiled eggs, right? And some of them are a little squished and, you know.
well loved.
Yes, right. Some are more beautiful than others. But so there's several things that you can do with hard-boiled eggs. And, of course, the most well-known is deviled eggs. So I would encourage you all to be creative in your deviled egg flavoring. I mean, you know, mayonnaise with a dash of mustard are the traditional things, but, you know, you could put chopped fresh chives or crumbled bacon or horseradish if you want a little twang or all kinds of things. So get creative with those deviled eggs. Or if you don't feel like making deviled eggs, just take – peel them all up and put them in a jar and cover it with half white wine vinegar white distilled vinegar and half water. And you can drop in some dried herbs, garlic, and let them sit for a couple of weeks or at least a week. And then you will have pickled eggs and they will still be good in the refrigerator for quite a long time. So don't feel guilty about those eggs going to waste. You know, you get kind of sick of Easter eggs by the end of Easter Sunday, but don't hesitate to make use of them in other ways. Repurposed Easter eggs, right?
Right. And remember, we're talking your original Easter fast food here. They're portable, they're edible, and they're very nutritious.
Yeah, you know, the kids are going to eat the chocolate, so they may eat one egg and the rest of it's the chocolate bunnies everybody's going for. So,
right. Another possibility for dyeing your Easter eggs. Donna mentioned the colored kits that you can get. You can get some non-toxic colors from grocery stores nowadays, and that's a good idea. You never know what's in the colors. But before you do that, find yourself your kids' coloring box, or the kids can find their own coloring box. Those wax crayons make really nice resists. You can draw all sorts of stuff on there. I would strongly suggest not using washable watercolor markers to draw on the eggs because it gets all over your hands and all over. It's just you're handling the eggs too much. But if you use some sort of wax to just write your name on the egg or make some little dots or make plaid. Plaid eggs are very nice.
So you like to decorate and then when you drop them in the dye.
Right.
The part where the wax crayon is doesn't get dyed, right?
Right. And especially if you use some nice bright colors, like some of the color even stays. Or you can use the end of a candle, too, to just make a clear sort of resist for your – put your name on there, right? Happy Easter.
Well, my daughter Diana, who's 40 and still a child at heart, everything is an excuse for our grandson. She just goes crazy at Easter. And so she's in New Zealand. And you know what the problem is there? I have to send her the dye because they don't really do it there.
Oh, really?
All the eggs in the markets there are brown.
Ah.
You really can't get white eggs in New Zealand. So It's been a challenge for our family, you know.
Well, you could still do.
Oh, she still dyes them.
Yeah, and you can use that resist method to make, you'd end up with brown lines, and if you make a nice blue dye, I mean, that's really pretty.
They're kind of cute. Easter egg is an Easter egg.
It is. It's part of our tradition here. Yes. Another thing about the Easter tradition is baking to go with the feast, the tradition of monks and nuns baking something. After all, we're talking about the start of the Eucharist, the Last Supper, the body and blood of Christ. And some of the nuns and monk bakers would get real creative by using their bread to actually create a body of Christ sort of thing that everybody could share. That sounds kind of macabre, but still, that was it. And making shapes, actually making little bunnies or whatever out of your buns, good idea.
Here's the time for another bad joke. What do you get when you pour hot water down a rabbit hole?
I have no idea.
A hot cross bunny.
Oh, yes, you do. Yes, you do.
So tell us about hot cross bunnies.
Hot cross buns are actually, again, street food. They've been that way for ages in England and in Europe. The vendors of these little pastries, which were very popular around Easter time, about in the spring, the vendors would sing, hot cross buns, one a penny, two a penny, hot cross buns. If you have no daughters, give them to your sons, one a penny, two a penny, hot cross buns. Hot cross buns, little small yeast-raised pastries. They were decorated this way even, or decorated and celebrated even in ancient Babylonian Egypt. But the familiar hot cross buns date back to England of the 1300s. And they were served during Good Friday and given, along with those eggs, to far-traveling churchgoers on Easter Sunday. So a recipe is just making a nice, sweet, yeast-raised bun. And this one is...
Now, they're not too sweet, usually.
No. This has a little sugar in it, but it's flavored with cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg, and currants, and finely diced, candied orange peels. And you let those little things raise. What makes some hot cross buns is traditionally they'd be raised in little circles, and you would cut a cross in them, indicating the Passion of Christ sort of thing. So you'd have a cross in it. But you do not have to do that. You can also just make a little drizzle of icing. And my recipe here calls for lemon frosting icing to make a little cross on top of the hot cross buns. People have been doing that thing for doing the buns and the celebratory food around Easter for a long time. The old Christian church would try to kind of keep everything very Christ-centered, but of course you've got the goddess and you've got bunnies and you've got Easters, and there's an interesting thing that the...
I wonder when the chocolate cream eggs came along.
Oh, yes. Oh, how nice. That's a good tradition. The Pope in the 10th century was actually talking about how you shouldn't celebrate any of this goddess stuff or bunnies or anything like that, because you shouldn't make your pastry in heathenish forms either. You shouldn't make pastries that were in the body of, like the body of Christ or in the shape of bunnies or anything. I have a recipe here. Well, actually, it's the same hot cross bun recipe, but they're called Easter pigeons. So it's making something just pretty. In a sense, you make a bun recipe and roll the little bits of dough into circles, into little ropes, and tie it into a knot. And you take one end of that knot on the bottom of the bun, pull it out, and make a little pointy end on it, and it makes the beak of a pigeon, and you put a little clove in for the pigeon eye, and you've got a little knotted up bun with a little pigeon head on it. And those are called Easter pigeons, and it's called a traditional Easter breakfast treat. I'm getting recipes here from the Sunset Cookbook of Breads. It's kind of my basic bread book.
It looks a little ancient.
It's pretty ancient, and it's really glommed up with a lot of goo on it because I've used this for a long time. One more thing about Easter. There's something called a Finnish Easter bread, traditionally cooked in a milking pail. In a milking pail to celebrate the birth of spring calves and the abundance of dairy foods in the spring. And I don't think you'd use a great big 5-gallon pail here, but you can use a small little pail, or it says you can put it in a couple of coffee cans. It's a mushroom-shaped Easter bread.
Do they still make those 5-pound coffee cans that, I mean, my parents always had them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you bake something in that.
Yeah.
And it comes out with sort of panettone shape because the top mushrooms out a little bit.
Finnish Easter bread. So that's celebrating Easter. And again, that has cardamom, lemon peel, orange peel, raisins. Oh, this is blanched almonds in it, too. So it's a thing to celebrate spring with and celebrate dairy foods, celebrate calves. And to serve this big bread that looks like a big mushroom, you cut the whole loaf in quarters. And then lay each quarter down and slice it off. It's good with soft cheeses. Again, celebrate your dairy herd there. Camembert, brie, breakfast cheeses, cream cheeses. So there's all kinds of things
Easter
you can do
brunch.
For Easter.
You know, something else that's very springy is if you stop by the horse barn over at ISU, you can see all the baby ponies.
Oh.
And they are so cute.
Oh, how nice.
That really makes you feel like... I don't know what it is. They're so cute. You get excited. Take the kids by or go have a look yourself.
Oh, goodness. Oh, goodness. So I think there's time for another joke here. We got to put in another.
Oh, here's some really bad ones. How do you catch a rabbit?
Oh, how do you catch a rabbit, Donna?
You hide behind a tree and make a noise like a carrot.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll have to think about that.
How many chocolate bunnies can you put into an empty Easter basket?
Oh.
This is a mathematical trick.
Oh, I don't know.
Just one. After that, the basket won't be empty.
Oh, picky, 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 picky.
Oh, yes.
Oh, all right. Speaking of baskets, what does the Easter Bunny get for making a basket? 2 points, just like everybody else. There you go. It's kind of strange. We're kind of scraping here on the bunny jokes, but it's good. Let's celebrate with another Easter-y kind of tune here.
Bonnet, with all the frills upon it, you'll be the grandest fellow in the Easter parade. I'll be all in clover, and when they look us over, we'll be the proudest couple in the Easter parade. Photographers will snap us, and you find that you're in the photograph.
Ah, that was the Easter Parade. Song written by Irving Berlin, published in 1933. A lot of people have sung that song. That was Judy Garland singing that song. It was sung in a film called Easter Parade. So there you go.
Did you have a new Easter dress and a bonnet and shoes every Easter?
Oh, when I was young enough to stand still for my mother to dress me in such, I guess I did. I had gloves and very, very uncomfortable shoes. That's part of the Easter tradition. Very uncomfortable shoes.
Shiny patent leather, usually with a buckle.
And some really unfortunate hats. There are family pictures of, oh, bad hats, but they were there. They were there.
Well, my mother, I had only one sibling, and we were only a year apart, so my mother really went all out for Easter. There are always two dresses, sometimes in contrasting colors, but the same, and then a little hat. And, of course, the gloves, it's true.
Yes,
Lon and I grew up wearing white gloves on Easter.
Yeah.
I know it sounds unbelievable now, but it really used to happen.
This is almost like the stuff from the ancient bead here. I mean, we've got our history, too. You're listening to KHOI FM 89.1 Community Radio for the heart of Iowa. We'll listen to another bit of banjo music because one can't get too much banjo music for Easter.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI FM. We're talking about Easter and eggs. There's lots of things you can do with eggs. And somebody had the good idea of making eggs filled with chocolate and chocolate eggs filled with other things. And that's a nice thing to do for Easter.
We did want to bring in one topic that's not about Easter. Here's the downer message for this week. Actually, there were two reports last week that came out about glyphosate, which is the chemical in Roundup Ready, which is, here in Iowa, we kind of live in an ocean of glyphosate because it is the number one pesticide and herbicide used on all the corn and soybeans. So when there's some new research about this chemical, we need to listen up. And last week, two bits of really heavily confirmed scientific information were released, and one of them was that, according to the UN, the research arm of the World Health Organization declared that the world's most widely used herbicide ingredient has shown to cause a variety of cancers. They declared that glyphosate is a probable carcinogen. So we'll probably be talking about that a lot more in the future. It really should concern us here, since we're kind of in glyphosate central. The other bit of news that came out, completely different study, was talking about how it seems that glyphosate also impairs the use of human antibiotics. So there's some serious science coming out here that we all need to be concerned about. And Lana and I promise you a future show on these glum topics.
Yeah.
A dose of unfortunate reality here in our Easter fantasy. But
glyphosate has been around since Monsanto patented it as Roundup in 1973. So it's been around for a while. And along with that, it's pretty nasty stuff. It does its job. Along with that, that also spurred people to genetically modify things to resist this glyphosate poisoning. The original use of glyphosate was to prevent weeds, but somewhere along the way it was discovered that a pre-harvest spraying of glyphosate directly onto the crop could make for an easier harvest as it desiccates the material. So wheat and cane sugar are often sprayed, the whole crop, before they're harvested to make it easier because it gets rid of all the weeds and the nasty bits in between. It makes it easy. So take a walk down the cereal aisle and look at all the stuff that has got wheat and sugar cane in it. Look at the cookies and crackers and breads and cakes. All those have a double dose of glyphosate, not just during the growing stages, but they're starting or have been used to help make the harvest easier. Now, glyphosate works because, and I get this from the internet, where do we get anything? Look up information on glyphosate. Monsanto applied for the patent on glyphosate with the full knowledge that it worked by blocking the shikimate pathways of plants and certain bacteria. Therefore, since people are not plants or bacteria, glyphosate should be safe, right? It just works on bacteria, no problem. But what we're finding out now, and what Monsanto didn't disclose, is that our human gut have all these pathways in it. We're full of bacteria, and this is huge. Without gut bacteria, people become very ill, malnourished, develop antibodies to their own organs, get depressed. So in the resurgence or the presence of so many people having trouble with having trouble with wheat and all the things about having a reaction to wheat might just be the fact that all of these gluten-based products like wheat that we eat still have some glyphosate on them. So be careful. Be careful.
As always, you get back to the organic is the golden standard. If you eat organic, you're going to reduce your exposure to these things. I mean, no one is immune to it. on the planet anymore. It's kind of everywhere. You know, be sure to check the garden herbs that you, I mean, the garden herbicides that you use. It's quite common as household sprays as well. Just kind of go for the greener, cleaner products if you can.
Please do, because if we are not able to digest wheat, and if our sugar cane has got this stuff on it, it's probably not so good. Maybe we should change our minds about using this stuff. Anyway, do your own research. Go on the internet and look up glyphosate and gluten intolerance.
And glyphosate poisoning, so that you understand what is around us. And we'll be talking more about this in a way that helps us not be paranoid about it, but really take some concrete steps to protect ourselves as much as we can.
Yeah.
So that was the bummer news, the Donna Downer for the week.
Oh, here's a little something from the Donalana Kitchen News Desk. Tick-a-dick, 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 tick-a-dick. That's our ticker tape. Tick-a-dick, tick-a-dick. There's been another food merger, and just to kind of keep you on your toes when you're
industrial food companies mergers.
Yeah, food companies. The companies of Kraft and Heinz are merging.
Think macaroni and cheese with ketchup poured on it.
Right. In consolidation, its consolidation will make the fifth largest food company in the world. H.J. Heinz Company is going to purchase Kraft Foods. And that includes all kinds of stuff. Ketchup and macaroni and cheese, lunch meats, Planters nuts, Maxwell coffee, Jell-O, Kraft singles, Orida potato products, Weight Watchers stuff, and Kool-Aid. So there's all that stuff. And you think, well, that wouldn't bother me at all. But the fact that this company is going to be so huge will have a whole lot of things to say and a whole lot of impact on its presence in the grocery store. The fact that they are a big, big company now, they can demand a lot of shelf space, even more than they have now. So kind of watch for that.
I wonder what their position as a corporate entity will be on GMO labeling. What do you suppose?
The fact that we have so many GMOs, like I mentioned, this glyphosate invention made GMOs kind of important, because if we can make certain crops tolerant of GMOs, then we can poison them more. But they might end up poisoning ourselves. And one thing after, like we say, we will deal with this more in a future show. I think it really bears talking about.
How about one more bad bunny joke?
Oh, of course.
This one's really bad. This is for a three-year-old, okay?
All right.
What do you get when you cross a rabbit with an elephant? An elephant who never forgets to eat his carrots.
Oh, my. That'll do it.
There you go. Happy Easter, everybody.
Yes. We have some upcoming things. And next week. Next week, as a matter of fact.
Oh, next week is a big week. After Easter, we have two major literary food forces coming to Ames, Iowa. The first one on Monday, April 6th, is Ava Chin is being brought by the Ag Arts community at ISU. Her book is called Eating Wildly, Foraging for Life, Love, and the Perfect Meal. She is the New York Times foraging editor, I believe. In case you didn't know, the New York Times has a foraging editor. She's a native New Yorker, and she will be speaking in the Memorial Union at 7 p.m. on Monday, April 6th. We will also have an interview with her on the show next week, so tune in to hear Ava Chin talk about foraging in New York City. And then that's Monday. Now, and then on Wednesday, only 2 days later, we have I would call him the number one American chef, Dan Barber, whose book is called The Third Plate, Beyond the Farm to Table, The Future of Food, Field Notes on the Future of Food. So he is the award-winning chef of the Blue Hill Restaurant with locations in Manhattan and also in the Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture. So He will be giving the Shivers Memorial Lecture, which is at 7 p.m. in the Sunroom, Wednesday, April 8th. There should also be some large articles about him in the Des Moines Register to kind of prepare you for him. I would encourage anybody who's interested in American food, that would be all of us,
yes,
to come and hear what Dan has to say. He's a very fine writer, and I've really enjoyed his book.
Good.
And we'll try to get some of him on the show maybe the following week.
That's good.
So we have a lot to look forward to next week.
Lots of good food. And here is a quick announcement that there is a wild mushroom certification course. If you want to learn everything to know about wild mushroom certification course, contact Practical Farmers of Iowa, Lauren Zastro. There is a really fine workshop available through the University of Wisconsin Extension. So contact Practical Farmers with that. We'll go out with a dance party tune. This is a square dance, and it also has some calls in. There you go. So, more tunes? You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And Donna Priskintos.
We've had fine engineering from Rick and taste testing, too, as usual, of our Easter eggs here. So have yourself a dandy Easter.
At least we have the right weather for Easter this year. That's something to be very grateful for.
Promenade with your Easter bonnet on. Yes, yes. Happy Easter. Eat good food and enjoy life.